This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
From harming us. Stay tuned to KBOO.
Hello, good people. This is Jamila from Guess Who's Coming to Radio. As you may already know, well-known local figure Kirk Reeves, also known as the Trumpet Man, has transcended. His white tuxedo and trumpet were recognizable to anyone crossing the Hawthorne Bridge or downtown Portland. Upon his transcendence, I made an open call to speak with others who knew or have experienced him, from the minor to the major. I am making an even larger call in order to produce a show in honor of his life and work. If you are interested in telling your story, please contact the Guess Who's Coming to Radio page on the KBOO.fm site. Thank you, and we look forward to hearing from you.
KBOO Radio is a proud media sponsor of the 28th annual Martin Luther King Day event. Keep Alive the Dream, an annual tribute to Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., produced by the World Arts Foundation. This year's event will take place at the New Beginnings Conference Center, 3300 Northeast 172nd Place in Portland. KBOO will again broadcast the annual celebration in its entirety. More information about this live broadcast can be found at kboo.fm/2013MLK.
Time is 11:02. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, the digital divide. Welcome to The Digital Divide. This is Rabia Yeaman, your host for today, and we ask ourselves on this program, how does technology, science, and metaphysics intersect? Can we use new science to advance society, and how do we keep it from harming us? KBOO's The Digital Divide attempts to answer these questions and ask a few of our own through interviews, recordings, and commentary. We cover topics as diverse as open source software and internet privacy, environmental science, metaphysics, bioethics, and more. Today, we'll have a report on the WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, a clip from a press conference he did. Be sure to tune in next Friday, January 18th at 11 a.m. Andrew Geller will be speaking with Joel Hirshhorn about technology addiction and whether the global embrace of mobile communications technology has spawned progress or a new form of servitude. Good question. And from The Guardian, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange said his work will not be cowed, as he promised the whistleblowing site would release a million more documents in 2013. In a speech from a balcony at the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he is living in exile. He said the files to be published in 2013 would affect every country in this world. It is 6 months since he sought asylum to avoid extradition to Sweden. He fears being sent to the U.S. and being punished in the same way that Bradley Manning has been and continues to be for leaking diplomatic files. A crowd of some 80 supporters gathered outside the building in Knightsbridge to listen to the 41-year-old Australian, whose website published a mass of leaked cables embarrassing a number of countries. And we have a little clip.
The Pentagon reissued its threats against me in September and claimed the very existence of WikiLeaks is an ongoing crime. My work will not be cowed. But why this immoral investigation continues and why the Australian government will not defend the journalism and publishing of WikiLeaks, I must remain here. However, the door is open, and the door has always been open for anyone who wishes to speak to me. Like you, I have not been charged with a crime. If you ever see spin that suggests otherwise, note this corruption of journalism, and then go to justiceforassange.com for the full facts. Tell the world the truth, and tell the world who lied to you.
That a clip from that press conference with Julian Assange. Mr. Assange entered the embassy after the UK Supreme Court dismissed his bid to reopen his appeal against extradition. Mr. Assange has been warned he will be arrested when he leaves the embassy for breaking the terms of his bail conditions, and offers from the Metropolitan Police continue to mount around-the-clock guard on the building. This is for someone who is sought for questioning, hasn't been committed or had any crime necessarily charged against him. A statement from the Ecuadorian ambassador said, "At a time of year when people come closer together, Ecuador reaffirms the solidarity that our country gave 6 months ago to a person who was being persecuted for thinking and expressing themselves freely." Calling for reflection, he went on to say, "Often it is necessary, as we have done in our beloved country of Ecuador, to stand up and face those enemies of democracy that, far from seeking unity and peace among the citizens of the world, instead seek to ruin socialist peoples and dominate on behalf of small groups of people." That update from Julian Assange. Also a little update from the Bradley Manning trial. The prosecutor, the federal prosecutor, has suggested that providing any media source with information that terrorists could potentially benefit from reading, hearing, or knowing, I'm paraphrasing, could constitute aiding and abetting an enemy. So watch out, all you writers out there. You don't want terrorists reading or talking about your work. Next up, we'll hear a talk by Wade Davis. Wade Davis is perhaps the most articulate and influential Western advocate of the world's indigenous cultures. He's a National Geographic explorer in residence and has been described as a rare combination of scientist, scholar, poet, and passionate defender of all life's diversity. Trained in anthropology and botany at Harvard, he travels the globe to live alongside indigenous people and document their cultural practices in books, photographs, and film. As a speaker, he parlays the sense of wonder into passionate concern over the rate at which cultures and languages are disappearing. 50% of the world's 7,000 languages, he says, are no longer taught to children. He argues in the most beautiful terms that language is much more than vocabulary and grammatical rules. Every language, he says, is an old-growth forest of the mind. And then later in the program, we'll also hear the premiere podcast episode of Ram Dass Here and Now. Raghu Marcus of the Love, Serve, Remember Foundation will explore the origin and early years of Ram Dass. Some consider Ram Dass to be a contemporary American mystic. This episode will introduce you to Ram Dass and his work. Up next, Wade Davis.
This part.
The Pentagon reissued.
You know, one of the intense pleasures of travel and one of the delights of ethnographic research is the opportunity to live amongst those who have not forgotten the old ways, who still feel their past in the wind, touch it in stones polished by rain, taste it in the bitter leaves of plants. Just to know that jaguar shamans still journey beyond the Milky Way, or the myths of the Inuit elders still resonate with meaning, or that in the Himalaya, the Buddha still pursue the breath of the Dharma, is to really remember the central revelation of anthropology, and that is the idea that the world in which we live in does not exist in some absolute sense, but is just one model of reality, the consequence of one particular set of adaptive choices that our lineage made, albeit successfully, many generations ago. And of course, we all share the same adaptive imperatives. We're all born, we all bring our children into the world, we go through initiation rites, we have to deal with the inexorable separation of death. So it shouldn't surprise us that we all sing, we all dance, we all have art. But what's interesting is the unique cadence of the song, the rhythm of the dance in every culture. And whether it is the Penan in the forests of Borneo, or the voodoo acolytes in Haiti, or the warriors in the Kaisu Desert of northern Kenya, the Curandero in the mountains of the Andes, or a caravansari in the middle of the Sahara — this is incidentally the fellow that I traveled into the desert with a month ago — or indeed a yak herder in the slopes of Chomalungma, Everest, the goddess mother of the world. All of these peoples teach us that there are other ways of being, other ways of thinking, other ways of orienting yourself in the earth. And this is an idea that, if you think about it, can only fill you with hope. Now, together, the myriad cultures of the world make up a web of spiritual life and cultural life that envelops the planet and is as important to the well-being of the planet as indeed is the biological web of life that you know as a biosphere. And you might think of this cultural web of life as being an ethnosphere, and you might define the ethnosphere as being the sum total of all thoughts and dreams, myths, ideas, inspirations, intuitions brought into being by the human imagination since the dawn of consciousness. The ethnosphere is humanity's great legacy. It's a symbol of all that we are and all that we can be as an astonishingly inquisitive species. And just as the biosphere is being severely eroded, so too is the ethnosphere, and if anything, at a far greater rate. No biologist, for example, would dare suggest that 50% of all species are moribund or on the brink of extinction, because it simply is not true. And yet that, the most apocalyptic scenario in the realm of biological diversity, scarcely approaches what we know to be the most optimistic scenario in the realm of cultural diversity. And the great indicator of that, of course, is language loss. When each of you in this room were born, there are 6,000 languages spoken on the planet. Now, a language is not just a body of vocabulary or a set of grammatical rules. A language is a flash of the human spirit. It's a vehicle through which the soul of each particular culture comes into the material world. Every language is an old-growth forest of the mind, a watershed of thought, an ecosystem of spiritual possibilities. And of those 6,000 languages, as we sit here today in Monterey, fully half are no longer being whispered into the ears of children. They're no longer being taught to babies, which means effectively, unless something changes, they're already dead. What could be more lonely than to be enveloped in silence, to be the last of your people to speak your language, to have no way to pass on the wisdom of the ancestors or anticipate the promise of the children? And yet that dreadful fate is indeed the plight of somebody somewhere on Earth roughly every 2 weeks, because every 2 weeks some elder dies and carries with him into the grave the last syllables of an ancient tongue. And I know there's some of you who say, well, wouldn't it be better, wouldn't the world be a better place if we all just spoke one language? And I say, great, let's make that language Yorba. Let's make it Cantonese. Let's make it Kogi. And you'll suddenly discover what it would be like to be unable to speak your own language. And so what I'd like to do with you today is sort of take you on a journey through the ethnosphere, a brief journey through the ethnosphere, to try to begin to give you a sense of what, in fact, is being lost. Now, there are many of us who sort of forget that when I say different ways of being, I really do mean different ways of being. Take, for example, this child of the Barasana in northwest Amazon, a people of the Anaconda who believe that mythologically they came up the Milk River from the east in the belly of sacred snakes. Now, this is a people who cognitively do not distinguish the color blue from the color green because the canopy of the heavens is equated to the canopy of the forest upon which the people depend. They have a curious language and marriage rule, which is called linguistic exogamy. You must marry someone who speaks a different language, and this is all rooted in mythological past. Yet the curious thing is in these longhouses where there are six or seven languages spoken because of intermarriage, you never hear anyone practicing a language. They simply listen and then begin to speak. Or one of the most fascinating tribes I ever lived with, the Warani of northeastern Ecuador, an astonishing people first contacted peacefully in 1958. In 1957, five missionaries attempted contact and made a critical mistake. They dropped from the air 8x10 glossy photographs of themselves and what we would say to be friendly gestures, forgetting that these people of the rainforest had never seen anything two-dimensional in their lives. So they picked up these photographs from the forest floor, tried to look behind the face to find the form of the figure, found nothing, and concluded that these were calling cards from the devil, and so they speared the five missionaries to death. But the Warani didn't just spear outsiders, they speared each other. 54% of their mortality was due to them spearing each other. We traced genealogies back 8 generations, and we found 2 instances of natural death. And when we pressured the people a little bit about it, they admitted that one of the fellows had gotten so old that he died getting old, so we speared him anyway. But at the same time, they had a perspicacious knowledge of the forest that was astonishing. Their hunters could smell animal urine at 40 paces and tell you what species left it behind. In the early 80s, I had a really astonishing assignment when I was asked by my professor at Harvard if I was interested in going down to Haiti, infiltrating the secret societies, which were the foundation of Duvalier's strength in the Tontamacute, and securing the poison used to make zombies. In order to make sense out of sensation, of course, I had to understand something about this remarkable faith of Voodoo. And Voodoo is not a black magic cult. On the contrary, it's a complex metaphysical worldview. It's interesting, if I asked you to name the great religions of the world, what would you say? Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Judaism, whatever. There's always one continent left out, as the assumption being that sub-Saharan Africa had no religious beliefs. Well, of course, they did. And Voodoo is simply the distillation of these very profound religious ideas that came over during the tragic diaspora of the slavery era. But what makes Voodoo so interesting is that it's this living relationship between living and the dead. So the living give birth to the spirits. The spirits can be invoked from beneath the great water, responding to the rhythm of the dance, to momentarily displace the soul of the living so that for that brief shining moment, the acolyte becomes the god. That's why the Voodooists like to say that you white people go to church and speak about God. We dance in the temple and become God. And because you are possessed, you are taken by the spirit, how can you be harmed? So you see these astonishing demonstrations, Voodoo acolytes in a state of trance, handling burning embers with impunity, a rather astonishing example of the ability of the mind to affect the body that bears it when catalyzing a state of extreme excitation. Now, of all the peoples that I've ever been with, the most extraordinary are the Kogi of the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta in northern Colombia. Descendants of the ancient Tairona civilization, which once carpeted the Caribbean coastal plain of Colombia, in the wake of the conquest, these people retreated into an isolated volcanic massif that soars above the Caribbean coastal plain. In a blood-stained continent, these people alone were never conquered by the Spanish. To this day, they remain ruled by a ritual priesthood, but their training for the priesthood is rather extraordinary. The young acolytes are taken away from their families at the age of 3 and 4, sequestered in a shadowy world of darkness and stone huts at the base of glaciers for 18 years. 2 9-year periods deliberately chosen to mimic the 9 months of gestation they spend in their natural mother's womb. Now they are metaphorically in the womb of the Great Mother. And for this entire time, they are enculturated into the values of their society, values that maintain the proposition that their prayers and their prayers alone maintain the cosmic, or we might say the ecological balance. And at the end of this amazing initiation, one day they're suddenly taken out, and for the first time in their lives, at the age of 18, they see a sunrise. And in that crystal moment of awareness of first light, as the sun begins to bathe the slopes of this stunningly beautiful landscape, suddenly everything they have learned in the abstract is affirmed in stunning glory. And the priest steps back and says, you see, it's really as I've told you. It is that beautiful. It is yours to protect. They call themselves the elder brothers, and they say we, who are the younger brothers, are the ones responsible for destroying the world. Now, this level of intuition becomes very important. Whenever we think of indigenous people and landscape, we either invoke Rousseau and the old canard of the noble savage, which is an idea racist in its simplicity, or alternatively, we invoke Thoreau and say these people are closer to the earth than we are. Well, indigenous people are neither sentimental nor weakened by nostalgia. There's not a lot of room for either in the malarial swamps of the Azmat or in the chilling winds of Tibet. But they have, nevertheless, through time and ritual, forged a traditional mystique of the earth that is based not on the idea of being self-consciously close to it, but on a far subtler intuition, the idea that the earth itself can only exist because it is breathed into being by human consciousness. Now, what does that mean? It means that a young kid from the Andes who's raised to believe that that mountain is an Apu spirit that will direct his or her destiny will be a profoundly different human being and have a different relationship to that resource or that place than a young kid from Montana raised to believe that a mountain is a pile of rock ready to be mined. Whether it's an abode of a spirit or a pile of ore is irrelevant. What's interesting is the metaphor that defines a relationship between the individual and the natural world. I was raised in the forests of British Columbia to believe those forests existed to be cut. That made me a different human being than my friends amongst the Kwagyuth who believed that those forests were the abode of Hukuk and the crooked beak of heaven and the cannibal spirits that dwelled at the north end of the world, spirits they would have to engage during their Hamatsa initiation. Now, if you begin to look at the idea that these cultures could create different realities, you can begin to understand some of their extraordinary discoveries. Take this plant here. It's a photograph I took in the Northwest Amazon just last April. This is ayahuasca, which many of you have heard about, the most powerful psychoactive preparation of the shaman's repertoire. What makes ayahuasca fascinating is not the sheer pharmacological potential of this preparation, but the elaboration of it. It's made really of two different sources. On the one hand, this woody liana, which has in it a series of beta carbolines, harmaline, mildly hallucinogenic. To take the vine alone is rather to have sort of blue, hazy smoke drift across your consciousness. But it's mixed with the leaves of a shrub in the coffee family called Psychotria viridis. This plant has in it some very powerful tryptamines, very close to brain serotonin, dimethyltryptamine, 5-methoxydimethyltryptamine. If you've ever seen the Yanomami blowing that snuff up their noses, that substance they make from a different set of species also contains 5-methoxydimethyltryptamine. To have that powder blown up your nose is rather like being shot out of a rifle barrel lined with Baroque paintings and landing on a sea of electricity. It doesn't create the distortion of reality, it creates the disillusion of reality. In fact, I used to argue with my professor, Richard Evans Schultes, who was the man who sparked the psychedelic era with his discovery of the magic mushrooms in Mexico in the 1930s. I used to argue that you couldn't classify these tryptamines as hallucinogenic because by the time you're under the effects, there's no one home anymore to experience a hallucination. But the thing about tryptamines is they cannot be taken orally because they're denatured by an enzyme found naturally in the human gut called monoamine oxidase. They can only be taken orally if taken in conjunction with some other chemical that denatures the MAO. Now, the fascinating thing is that the beta carbolines found within that liana are MAO inhibitors of the precise sort necessary to potentiate the tryptamine. So you ask yourself a question, how in a flora of 80,000 species of vascular plants did these people find these two morphologically unrelated plants that when combined in this way created a kind of biochemical version of the whole being greater than the sum of the parts? Well, we use that great euphemism, trial and error, which is exposed to be meaningless. But you ask the Indians and they say the plants talk to us. Well, what does that mean? Well, this tribe, the Kofan, has 17 varieties of ayahuasca, all of which they distinguish a great distance in the forest, all of which are referable to our eye as one species. And then you ask them how they established their taxonomy, and they say, I thought you knew something about plants. I mean, don't you know anything? And I said, no. Well, it turns out you take each of the 17 varieties on the night of a full moon, and it sings to you in a different key. Now, that's not going to get you a PhD at Harvard, but it's a lot more interesting than counting stamens. Now, the problem is that even those of us sympathetic with the plight of the indigenous people view them as quaint and colorful, but somehow reduced to the margins of history as the real world, meaning our world, moves on. Well, the truth is the 20th century, 300 years from now, is not going to be remembered for its wars or its technological innovations, but rather as the era in which we stood by and either actively endorsed or passively accepted the massive destruction of both biological and cultural diversity on the planet. Now, the problem isn't change. All cultures through all time have constantly been engaged in a dance with new possibilities of life. And the problem is not technology itself. The Sioux Indians did not stop being Sioux when they gave up the bow and arrow any more than an American stopped being an American when he gave up the horse and buggy. It's not change or technology that threatens the integrity of the ethnosphere. It is power, the crude face of domination. And whenever you look around the world, you discover that these are not cultures destined to fade away. These are dynamic, living peoples being driven out of existence by identifiable forces that are beyond their capacity to adapt to. Whether it's the egregious deforestation in the homeland of the Penan, a nomadic people from Southeast Asia, from Sarawak, a people who lived free in the forest until a generation ago and now have all been reduced to servitude and prostitution on the banks of the rivers, where you can see the river itself is soiled with the silt that seems to be carrying half of Borneo away to the South China Sea, where the Japanese freighters hang light on the horizon ready to fill their holds with raw logs ripped from the forest. Or in the case of the Yanomami, it's the disease entities that have come in the wake of the discovery of gold. Or if we go into the mountains of Tibet, where I'm doing a lot of research recently, you'll see it's a crude face of political domination. You know, genocide, the physical extinction of a people, is universally condemned, but ethnocide, the destruction of a people's way of life, is not only not condemned, it's universally, in many quarters, celebrated as part of a development strategy. And you cannot understand the pain of Tibet until you move through it at the ground level. I once traveled 6,000 miles from Chengdu in western China over land through southeastern Tibet to Lhasa with a young colleague, and it was only when I got to Lhasa that I understood the face behind these statistics you hear about. 6,000 sacred monuments torn apart to dust and ashes, 1.2 million people killed by the cadre during the Cultural Revolution. This young man's father had been a scribe for the Panchen Lama. That meant he was instantly killed at the time of the Chinese invasion. His uncle fled with His Holiness in the diaspora that took the people to Nepal. His mother was incarcerated for the crime of being wealthy. He was smuggled into the jail at the age of two to hide beneath her skirt tails because she couldn't bear to be without him. The sister who had done that brave deed was put into an education camp. One day she inadvertently stepped on an armband that of Mao, and for that transgression she was given 7 years of hard labor. The pain of Tibet can be impossible to bear, but the redemptive spirit of the people is something to behold. And in the end, then, it really comes down to a choice. Do we want to live in a monochromatic world of monotony, or do we want to embrace a polychromatic world of diversity? Margaret Mead, the great anthropologist, said before she died that her greatest fear that was that as we drifted toward this blandly amorphous generic worldview, not only would we see the entire range of the human imagination reduced to a more narrow modality of thought, but that we would wake from a dream one day having forgotten that there were even other possibilities. And it's humbling to remember that our species has perhaps been around for 600,000 years. The Neolithic Revolution, which gave us agriculture, at which time we succumbed to the cult of the seed, the poetry of the shaman was displaced by the prose of the priesthood, we created hierarchy, specialization, surplus, is only 10,000 years ago. The modern industrial world as we know it is barely 300 years old. Now, that shallow history doesn't suggest to me that we have all the answers for all of the challenges that will confront us in the ensuing millennia. When these myriad cultures of the world are asked the meaning of being human, they respond with 10,000 different voices. And it's within that song that we all rediscover the possibility of being what we are, a fully conscious species, fully aware of ensuring that all peoples in all gardens find a way to flourish. And there are great moments of optimism. This is a photograph I took at the northern tip of Baffin Island when I went narwhal hunting with some Inuit people. And this man, Olayak, told me a marvelous story of his grandfather. The Canadian government has not always been kind to the Inuit people, and during the 1950s, to establish our sovereignty, we forced them into settlements. This old man's grandfather refused to go. The family, fearful for his life, took away all of his weapons, all of his tools. Now, you must understand that the Inuit did not fear the cold. They took advantage of it. The runners of their sleds were originally made of fish wrapped in caribou hide. So This man's grandfather was not intimidated by the Arctic night or the blizzard that was blowing. He simply slipped outside, pulled down his sealskin trousers, and defecated into his hand. And as the feces began to freeze, he shaped it in the form of a blade. He put a spray of saliva on the edge of the shit knife, and as it finally froze solid, he butchered a dog with it. He skinned the dog and improvised a harness, took the rib cage of the dog and improvised a sled, harnessed up an adjacent dog, and disappeared over the ice floes, shit knife and belt. Talk about getting by with nothing. And this, in many ways, is a symbol of the resilience of the Inuit people and of all Indigenous people around the world. The Canadian government in April of 1999 gave back to total control of the Inuit an area of land larger than California and Texas put together. It's our new homeland. It's called Nunavut. It's an independent territory. They control all mineral resources. An amazing example of how a nation state can seek restitution with its people. And finally, in the end, I think it's pretty obvious, at least to all of us who have traveled in these remote reaches of the planet, to realize that they're not remote at all. They're homelands of somebody. They represent branches of the human imagination that go back to the dawn of time. And for all of us, the dreams of these children, like the dreams of our own children, become part of the naked geography of hope. So what we're trying to do at the National Geographic, finally, is we believe that politicians will never accomplish anything. We think that polemics are not persuasive, but we think that storytelling can change the world. And so we are probably the best storytelling institution in the world. We get 35 million hits on our website every month. 156 nations carry our television channel. Our magazines are read by millions. And what we're doing is a series of journeys to the ethnosphere where we're going to take our audience to places of such cultural wonder that they cannot help but come away dazzled by what they have seen, and hopefully therefore embrace gradually, one by one, the central revelation of anthropology, that this world deserves to exist in a diverse way, that we can find a way to live in a truly multicultural, pluralistic world where all of the wisdom of all peoples can contribute to our collective well-being. Thank you very much.
And you've been listening to a talk by Wade Davis. Coming up next, Ram Dass.
This podcast is brought to you by the Love Serve Remember Foundation and Ramdas.org.
Hi, I'm Raghu Marcus. As many of you know, Ram Dass partnered with Timothy Leary to help create the psychedelic movement of the late 60s. In his quest, Ram Dass was looking for a map of consciousness, a map that would answer all of life's big questions. Who am I, being one of the biggest? What am I doing here? What is this culture that I'm living in the midst of? And so when psychedelics did not totally do it for him, he went to India to find the map. What he found was an enlightened being who knew everything about him and saw him as no one had seen him before, that is, without judgment and only with love. It was Ram Dass's first experience of unconditional love. Now, when Ram Dass came back to America, he toured the country sharing that experience and speaking the words that would become the book, Be Here Now. Of course, before he left India, his guru told him, do not say a word about me. And that's all he did when he came back. Now, at that time, I was the program director of a major alternative rock station in Montreal, Quebec. As far as spirituality was concerned, all I knew about was the Hare Krishna people at the airport, but I had seen a picture of an Indian saint named Meher Baba, and underneath were the words, don't worry, be happy. Well, I dug that. That made real sense to me. That was the beginning of something making sense. So one day I received a call from a promoter asking me to get the station to promote a lecture by a man named Ram Dass. I had no idea of a Ram Dass, but then he told me that it was Richard Alpert. Did I not know Richard and Tim? Of course, I loved them, and so I asked the promoter to send me a previous lecture of this Ram Dass, and I would let him know if we could support the evening. The tape was sent to me that day, and I went into the studio. Everything I had been needing to hear about how all this works for years and years of thinking about this stuff, suddenly clarity. But it wasn't just the words, it was the presence of the voice, the idea that I could be happy. Suddenly everything made way more sense. So I played Ram Dass lectures day after day on that rock and roll station, and the response was incredible. People had never heard anything like this before. And in fact, when I finally did make it to India, there were some people from Montreal who had heard these lectures and got turned on and made their way there, and we have been close ever since. So here is a bit of what we heard back then.
The wild geese who do not intend to cast their reflection, and the water has no mind to receive their image. That was the first message I got from the first fortune cookie I opened when I returned from India. And it seems like a fitting contract for these meetings, and perhaps the full implications of that contract will become clear as the afternoon continues. What I'd like to do is to present a model to you and the specific model is my own life experience. That's really all I have to offer to you on my own experience. And I would like to clarify the reason for doing this. It is not my expectation or my hope that any of you necessarily would undergo the particular journey that I am pursuing. I am not proselytizing for Ashtanga Yoga. But we in the West are faced with a very interesting predicament. Through a variety of circumstances, some of which are built into the culture, like changes in communication media and so on. Some of them are the result of the chemicals that have appeared and been widely used. Psychedelics. Some of them are personal experiences people have had which previously they kept hidden, but now they begin to redefine, or they've hidden them under labels the society provided them, which made them seem like psychosis or insanity or something. And they now reconsider them. As a result of all these circumstances, many people in the West, including me, and I assume you, and that must be what's bringing you here, appreciate the possibility of states of consciousness other than our normal waking state of consciousness. Or maybe you're here just because you look at the world in which you're living and you say, well, we obviously can't handle it with what we've got going, so I'll at least look for something else, even though you may not have the faith and the possibility that there is something else, but you're going to look anyway. So we're presented with a possibility, and it filters through to us from one source or another, that there is a very ancient tradition of people who have realized other states of consciousness and have sent messages and made maps. But the problem that we have as Westerners is that we can't understand the maps. The maps are there. The secrets are not secrets in the sense of I'm not going to tell you. They're secrets in the sense that we can't hear. Jung, in his his writings in the book by Wilhelm called The Secret of the Golden Flower, it's a eulogy to Wilhelm. He commends Wilhelm for having the courage as a Westerner to give up his predispositions of thought, to be able to get into that position from which he could appreciate the Eastern writings from an inside point of view. In other words, give up his identity as a Westerner. The term that you may be familiar with that's required is what's called surrender. And so what we can do for one another as Westerners is collect the data that are available to each of us as we open ourselves to them. We are all in a journey. We are, just as Hermann Hesse talks about, the fellow travelers on our journey to the East. East not being literal necessarily, but metaphorical. And what we can do is we can help each other along. We can be the satsang, the sangha, the spiritual community, the support for one another, giving each other the confidence to keep pursuing this possibility. And we give each other our own lives to help, and that's what I would like to do today, is to present, as I say, the model, because maybe there'll be some clues in it that will be of some use to you in your own sadhana, in your own spiritual journey. But in doing this, I am going to work on myself throughout this whole afternoon, as I'm always doing, doing my mantra, japa, and therefore I'm really not speaking, I should tell you, and I hope you aren't listening. Because the place where I am, and I hope you are, is the same place, where we together are witnessing one of us speaking and the rest of us listening. But let's not get trapped in our social roles. Okay? It's a good exercise. Now, the reason that my life may be useful, although from most other standpoints it seems, even to me, quite trivial, is that I have a... he led three lives. I have three chapters, each of which is led quite naturally into the next, although at the time it didn't seem very natural. The first chapter was that of being a social scientist. The second was that of being a explorer in the psychedelic community. And the third is that of being a student of Ashtanga Yoga. And I'm going to take you through my trip to show you why each of those transformations occurred as best as I can. In 1961, in the fall of 61, I was at the height of my academic career. I had obtained my PhD from Stanford in psychology, and through a more charm than scholarship, I will admit, I had obtained a assistant professorship at Harvard, and a number of research grants, and a role as a therapist at the health service, and at the time I had research contracts at Yale and Stanford, and I was on leave from Harvard and teaching at the University of California at Berkeley. So I had four major universities cornered. And in the academic ladder, that's climbing pretty fast. I was 28. And I was being groomed for all kinds of things, right? I was definitely on my way up. Now, as a result of working these 70 hours a week, I was amassing a lot of money. And I was using this money to live as a cosmopolite or a bachelor under these circumstances. Mine, I had an apartment filled with antiques and a Mercedes-Benz and a Cessna airplane and a Triumph motorcycle and a MG sports car and a sailboat, and I went to the Caribbean skin diving, and I, you know, that kind of life. And I, was an empire builder, very simply. That's the best way I'd label myself. Well, with it all, although it looked awfully good on paper, there was something wrong inside about it. I don't think I'm yet ready to be able to label, because I'm probably not free enough to be able to have objective understanding of it. To be able to label what really didn't feel right, I can give you some clues about what didn't feel right. One of the problems was I was teaching these very hip courses at Harvard. I was teaching Freud and human motivation, personality development, and clinical psychology. And all of these students would come seeking my wisdom. And the problem was that I knew I didn't know. I mean, I knew everything you had to know in order to be a professor of psychology at Harvard. But when you got down to the nitty-gritty of what had something to do with people's lives, I knew that it all didn't add up right, because I had these various roles. I was a researcher studying child development. And so I could see how the variables we were working with didn't quite get to what that kid was all about. Then I was a therapist, and so many hours a week I had somebody sitting on the other side of the desk, and he was playing patient, I was playing doctor, and I would sit and I'd run through my list of theories as he would run through his list of symptoms, and we'd compare them and match them up, and you know, it wasn't enough. It didn't quite gel. It was as if psychology had a reason to be as defensive as it was. Because as if behaviorism hadn't quite gotten hold of the critical variables in the human experience. And I looked around, I looked at my colleagues, my psychological and psychiatric colleagues, and they seemed to be really just about as neurotic as anybody else. And they would come and they would be psychologists from 9 to 5, and then they would go home, and they seemed to be roughly as hung up in their marriages. Their children seemed to be as destructive as other people's children. They seemed to show the same personality manifestations. And it seemed a fair question that if all of these theories were so good and these people were the masters of them, why wasn't it reflected in their own human behavior? Now, I had really tried, I had gone through 5 years of psychoanalysis, and most people hide behind that and say, well, it was a didactic analysis. That is, I did it so that I could help others. It's a teaching thing. I didn't do it. I did it because I was neurotic, and I paid because I was sick and I wanted to get well, because I knew that I wasn't making it in the world the right way, even though all the credits were, you know, the byline had all the credits. But at the end of 5 years of psychoanalysis, it was apparent that since I knew a lot about Freud and could keep pointing out to my analysts where he was making misinterpretations on the basis of a 1906 paper or something like that, that my defenses were at least as strong as his tools. That's all that roughly $25,000 demonstrated to me. I hope those of you that are invested in those particular professional roles will appreciate that I'm probably still merely acting out my negative transference. And as far as the other things in my life, if you take the motorcycle, when I first got the motorcycle, I loved to climb hills with a motorcycle and do hill climbing races and things. And go roaring off into the night in the California hills at 95 miles an hour with my girl holding onto the back and the wind blowing and holding on for dear life. And there was a thrill. There was something that was very great. And it would, at the moment, there would be a moment when it would just feel, just that place would feel good inside. That was about one moment. Then all the rest of the time it was cold, you know, or it was rainy. And so after the newness wore off, the motorcycle sat in the garage, and the airplane sat out the landing strip, you know, because after a while, each of the things, the possibilities of each of those vehicles for giving me that thing I was looking for inside had been explored. And they were very finite, and I had appreciated what their limits were. Now, it was at this time that, just as this, I was settling into working for my tenure. That is, I was told, if you get your publications in order, we're holding a chair for you. Which meant, you know, publish or perish. Get those books out. Look good on paper. And so I was doing just that. And although it was a little discouraging to see that it, I already saw that this wasn't going to make it in life, and yet this was my commitment for the next 40 years or so. Now, I had a big corner office at Harvard with two secretaries and about 40 research assistants, and as I say, I was an empire builder. And down the hall, in a little closet-like place, there was this other guy who had come back from Italy, who had been riding a bicycle around Italy and had been found by the chairman of the department, who brought him back as the new bright thing for the department, and his name was Timothy Leary. And he was a fun-loving, drinking Irishman. And we were bachelors, and so we started to share evenings together and he said he was going to Mexico in the summer, and I said that I'd like to come down too, and that we ought to fly, take a trip across the north of South America in a little plane. And I told him I flew, which wasn't exactly true. I had a student license at the time. And he said, great, then we would meet in Cuernavaca on a certain date, and we would take off from there. So I then secretly went out and got my license. And then nobody would trust me with a plane, so I had to buy one. The bank bought it, actually. And off I went with the license one day old for this hair-raising trip, believe me, quite hair-raising trip over the mountains into central Mexico. Well, when I got there, Tim had just had this experience in which he had taken the sacred mushrooms of Mexico, which he had gotten from a woman called Crazy Juana, a curandero up in the hills, who would put one in your hand and two in her mouth. And I heard many stories about what had happened to him in this experience. There weren't any more of the mushrooms around, and we didn't take the trip across South America. We just hung out down in Tepoztlan and Cuernavaca. And then we flew back to the United States together in the plane, with his son and an iguana. And I went to Berkeley, so I couldn't do anything more. And he went back to Harvard to start exploring these chemicals, because he said he had learned more in this one experience than he had in all of his years as a psychologist. So when I came back to Harvard in the spring, I was quite eager to have this experience. And he had gotten hold of the synthetic of these called psilocybin. So on March 6th in 1961, it was the night of the biggest snowstorm of the year, and my parents' home was about two blocks away from Tim's big house. And I went to my parents to visit, and then I trudged through the snow and went over to Tim's house to turn on, which we did in the kitchen with a variety of assorted people in our usual highly controlled manner. And the first part of the experience had that certain unpredictability about it, that Tim's son's dog had been out running in the snow and came in, and in our timeless minds it seemed like it was gasping for breath too long and we thought it was going to die. And it was by then 12 o'clock midnight Saturday night in a raging blizzard, and we imagined ourselves carrying this dog to the veterinarian 4 miles away when we weren't even sure the dog, it wasn't just us. So we called his son down from upstairs to ask him to see how he would act with the dog. And he came down, the dog played with him, so we assumed everything was...
We've been listening to the premiere broadcast of Ram Dass Here and Now, and you'll be able to, later this afternoon, get those links online at the KBOO website, kboo.fm. Just look for the blog for Digital Divide. You'll be able to find links to the videos and audio that we heard today. Tune in every second Friday of the month at 11 a.m. Be sure and tune in next Friday, the 18th. Andrew Geller will be interviewing a gentleman on addiction to technology, a topic near and dear to my heart. And be sure, when you go to the KBOO website, click donate, become a member, support your non-corporate, non-commercial community radio station. Coming up next, the noon headline news, followed by Moving On with Don Jacobson.
It's time for KBOO News at Noon. I'm Dan Johnson. When the Portland Police Review Board met to consider the future of Todd Wyatt, a veteran of over 20 years with the police bureau, they found his testimony untruthful and felt he lacked the ability to perform his duties with integrity, then voted 5-1 to fire Wyatt. But Chief of Police Mike Reese intervened, choosing instead to demote Wyatt from the captain's position to that of a lieutenant. A woman in Dublin, Ireland, who is terminally ill with multiple sclerosis, wants to die with dignity by assisted suicide. There is one glitch in the works, and that is, it is a crime for anyone to help or assist another person die. It is in the Constitution, according to Dublin's High Court. There is no word as to whether she will appeal the decision. Wedding bells will be ringing at Washington's National Cathedral for many gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender members of the church that want to tie the knot. National Cathedral will be among the first Episcopal congregations to open its doors for gay marriage. For those living in the Gaza Strip who might become ill, they had better hope that it's not too serious. The Palestinian Ministry of Health in the Gaza Strip reports that over 600 types of medications and supplies have gone missing. Among the meds that can cause the most concern are those used for heart medication and anemia. We're going to start something new on Fridays here. It's called the Question of the Week. Starting today, we're going to ask for your opinion on current news events. The question today is, what do you think Vice President Joe Biden should recommend to President Obama on Tuesday about firearm regulations? Tell us what you think by going to our email address, pmnews@kabu.org. That's pmnews@kabu.org. And in the subject line, write recommendations to the president. Weather today in the Portland area will be cold, mostly sunny, some clouds though, with highs in the upper 30s. Tonight it's going to get chilly, right down around 28 degrees. Listen, everyone.